Basically, today we're going to go ahead and Scott's going to start us off with a little overview of what's in the preface and the forewords, and then I'm going to give a little bit of history on the doctor's opinion and its importance and how it came to be part of the basic text of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. So, Scott, why don't you come on up here?
Sure.
Thank you. Oh, good. You guys will have to bear with me. I'm multitasking. Recording and speaking. My name is Scott Mann, very definitely an alcoholic. I was separated from alcohol on November 28, 1997. It's a real honor to be here with you guys. Before I get started, I want you to know that each and every one of you people has influenced my sobriety. I am absolutely convinced that every single person that walks in these doors has influenced my life in one way or another. And a little bit about what we're going to do here. Matthew and I have, you know, we talk inside the program and outside of the program, and we realized that a lot of people, they talk about the Big Book, but do people absolutely understand the Big Book and the doctor's opinion? Okay? One of the biggest myths, and I want to start out with this, one of the biggest myths you hear in these rooms is that there's 164 pages. Matter of fact, let's get a show of hands. How many people's sponsor has said read the first 164 pages? And guess what? You probably skipped over the doctor's opinion, right? Right? Have you drank again? Yeah? Well, I like audience participation, and I think that's what's going to open this up for everybody to feel like we're a part of. I do not represent Alcoholics Anonymous. I represent a sober person who has stayed sober in spite of myself. Okay? But I think that the doctor's opinion is the essence of the first step. If I don't understand the doctor's opinion, real good chance I'm going to drink booze again. Real good chance. Because the doctor's opinion lays out the allergy, the obsession of the mind, and obviously the spiritual malady. The three parts, the body, the mind, and the spirit of the illness. I used to understand the spirit of the illness, but I guarantee I didn't understand the body or the mind. I just thought it was only a moral issue. Okay? I.e., I went down to the Pentecostal church every Sunday morning, every Wednesday night, and I rededicated my life. But for whatever reason, I couldn't stop drinking when I did that. And I had no idea this is not just a moral issue. Okay? They didn't tell me that at the Pentecostal church. They didn't say, well, buddy, you're suffering from an allergy of the body, and you're condemned by an obsession of the mind to drink yourself to death. They said, brother, just keep coming back to the altar calls. God's going to change your life. And I'm not here to talk about what the Pentecostal church did or didn't do. But that was my experience before, prior to coming to Alcoholics Anonymous. Long story made short, I want to start out at the very beginning. The doctor's opinion is what we're hoping we'll get through today, but I want to start you guys out on the preface.
Can I say a prayer? Open the meeting with prayer?
Yeah, you forgot the prayer, didn't you? Thank you, John.
I'm an alcoholic.
That's okay. Yeah, let's go ahead and have a prayer, guys. Let's have a moment of silence followed by the serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Okay. So we're going to start on page XI, Roman numeral 11. Has everybody got a book? You don't have a book? Dale, do you mind bringing out the books from the back for the folks who don't have the books? So I want everybody to follow along with me, if at all possible. Hopefully you brought your highlighter. We're going to make some notes. And what we're going to do is I'm just going to go through one paragraph at a time. Some stuff is pertinent to your sobriety. Some stuff isn't. But we're going to go ahead and go through it the way my sponsor did it with me. One paragraph at a time. It says at the top of the preface, this is the fourth edition of the book Alcoholics Anonymous. The first edition appeared in April 1939. And the following 16 years, more than 300,000 copies went into circulation. The second edition, published in 1955, reached a total of more than 1,150,500 copies. The third edition, which came off the press in 1976, achieved a circulation of approximately 19,550,000 copies in all formats. Okay, there's some good information there for me. Basically, one thing I want to say about the Big Book, it's not as much what it says as what it means. That's what my sponsor wanted me to understand when I went through this book with him. He says, don't read this thing just literally for what it says. Try to find the underlying meaning. And what that first paragraph means to me is, in 1939 when this book was written, they put out 300,000 copies. Sounds like a lot of copies, right? But in 1976, there were 20 million copies in circulation. So what that says to me is this is an important book. We went from 300,000 copies, and then 41 years later, I think it's 41, forgive me if my math's wrong, but 1976, we've got 20 million copies out there. If this book was not important and this book did not work, I promise you it wouldn't have increased like that. Okay? So let's go to the second paragraph. It says, because this book has become the basic text for our society and has helped such large numbers of alcoholic men and women to recovery, there exists strong sentiment against any radical changes being made in it. Therefore, the first portion of this volume describing the AA recovery program has been left untouched in the course of revisions made for the second, third, and fourth editions. The section called The Doctor's Opinion has been kept intact, just as it was originally written in 1939 by the late Dr. William D. Silkworth, our society's great medical benefactor. Okay, there's a very, very important sentence there for me in the very first line. Okay? It says, because this book has become the basic text. So it's saying this book is a textbook. What were textbooks when you guys were in school? You went home and studied textbooks, right? Okay? See, that this was not my experience the first 6 years of sobriety, physical sobriety. I like to say that, physical sobriety. Because I don't know if I was really sober then. Because I hadn't been introduced to this book to this level until I went to an 81-year-old man on the east side of town. And ever since I got with him, I've been a free man. The textbook philosophy, I used to think this was just a nonfiction novel. Okay, you go pick it up in the self-help section at Barnes & Noble, right? Anybody else ever thought that? Well, that's not what this is saying. This is a textbook. Okay? I have to study this book if I want to recover from alcoholism. Not read it, study it. Reading it and studying it, two different ballgames. So it's already telling us this is a textbook and we're only on the second paragraph of this book. Okay? And it talks a little bit about the section called The Doctor's Opinion has been kept intact. So the doctor's opinion has stayed the same since 1939, i.e., once again, there's some important information in that chapter. Otherwise, they would have changed it by now. So let's go to the third paragraph. It says, the second edition added the appendices, the 12 traditions, and the directions for getting in touch with AA. But for the chief change was in the section of personal stories, which was expanded to reflect the fellowship's growth. Bill's story, Dr. Bob's nightmare, and one other personal history from the first edition were retained intact. Three were edited, and one of these was retitled. New versions of two stories were written with new titles. 30 completely new stories were added, and the story section was divided into three parts under the same headings that are used now. Only thing that says to me is basically, you know, we've got four editions of this book that have been written. And I guess each edition, we've had different types of members coming in. We've had new experience, new members. Therefore, they've changed the personal stories up a little bit to reflect the change in AA membership. Okay, and I'm assuming that when we write it, when the fifth edition of this book is wrote, there'll also be some changes then. Because I think that AA is constantly changing. But we need to hope that it's changing for the better and not the worse. And we'll get into that later on. So the third edition, Part 1, Pioneers of AA, was left untouched. Nine of the stories in Part 2, They Stopped in Time, were carried over from the second edition. Eight new stories were added. In Part 3, they lost nearly all. Eight stories were retained and five new ones were added. The only thing that jumped out at me on that is I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I've been sober since the age of 23. I was in the minority. the group that I got sober in, the Harbor group, I do not think there was another person my age at that time when I came in. So I got a mind from the very beginning that was telling me, you may not be an alcoholic. Okay? From the very get-go. You know, when you're 23 years old and all your peers are, you know, late 40s, 50s, my mind's trying to get me out the door. Okay? And some of you guys can probably still relate to this. You may think you're too young to be an alcoholic now. Right? But anyway, I went to a guy in the meeting one time in Harbor, and he said there's a section in the back of the book. It's called They Stopped in Time. And it was written from young people's perspectives. That man may have saved my life that day. Okay? I didn't know about this. And so I went to the back of the book, and lo and behold, there were about 8 stories that were reflective of people that got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous at a young age. See, every time I've been willing to seek, God has always provided an answer for me. But I got to say, first couple of years, I had a lot of doubts if I was an alcoholic. I really did. Not to think about all the misery, the panic attacks, anxiety attacks, guilt, shame, and remorse. See, my mind doesn't even think about that stuff. It talks about that. We're unable to bring into consciousness the suffering and humiliation of even a week or a month ago. So I'm sitting in Alcoholics Anonymous wondering if I'm an alcoholic. I didn't remember the time I wanted to blow my brains out at the age of 20 years old. Okay? So we're dealing with some serious business here, a serious mental illness. So I think it talks a little bit about, and everybody's going to find something in this book that relates to them on a personal level. I'm sharing my experience, hoping that maybe it will spawn something in you guys that you will see. Next part says, the fourth edition includes the 12 concepts for world service and revises the 3 sections of personal stories as follows. 1 new story has been added to part 1, and 2 that originally appeared in part 3 have been repositioned there. 6 stories have been deleted. 6 of the stories in part 2 have been carried over. 11 new ones have been added, and 11 taken out. Okay, this is pretty monotonous now, okay? Part 3 now includes 12 new stories. 8 were removed in addition to the 2 that were transferred to part 1. Okay, we got a lot of information there. It's basically reiterating how much the book has changed. It's kind of funny, too, how much has changed. I mean, you got to realize, we still got alcoholics writing this book. You know, we're opinionated people. And I'm sure they're very opinionated up in New York, too, even though they're at the GSO. So there's a lot of changes going on here. The 12 concepts of world service is basically service at a world level. Okay, so we've got the service at personal recovery first. Then we've got service at a group level. And then you have service at the world level. Okay, and that's what the 12 concepts for world service are. Last paragraph on the preface says, all changes made over the years in the Big Book, AA members' fond nickname for this volume, have had the same purpose, to represent the current membership of Alcoholics Anonymous more accurately, and thereby to reach more alcoholics. Okay? So that sums up everything we just talked about, that the Big Book has changed only to represent and help more alcoholics. Okay? If you have a drinking problem, we hope that you may pause in reading one of the 42 personal stories and think, yes, that happened to me, or more important, yes, I felt like that, or most important, yes, I believe this program can work for me too. Okay? And so if you skip the first 100, if you just read the first 164 pages, you just skipped some real good information, didn't you? Right? And again, I'm speaking from personal experience because I've done it before. I really have. And I was a dead man walking. I was a dead man walking. So let's go into the foreword of the first edition. I told Matthew I wasn't going to be long-winded, but it's almost a contradiction to my nature. Okay, so we're on page Roman numeral 13, foreword of the first edition. And remember, you guys can take notes. Highlighter's great, but I usually have a pen beside me too. AA is 4 years old when this AA was 4 years old when this book was written. Can you imagine these guys going from 1935 to 1939? Absolutely blind. I mean, they didn't have anything down in writing of their concepts and their beliefs. They were studying everybody else's concepts and beliefs at that point. And I think that's the reason Bill wrote this book ultimately, is he realized, I've got to get this down on paper. It's going to have a lot greater effect on alcoholics if it's down on paper, somewhere that people can look at it. So in 1939, when this book was written, AA was 4 years old. It says, we of Alcoholics Anonymous are more than 100 men and women who have recovered, past tense, from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. To show other alcoholics precisely how we have recovered is the main purpose of this book. There's some real important information there for me. Okay? Recovered. There's some more controversy. How many recovering alcoholics? Do you hear that a lot in here? You hear recovering? Okay, well let me clarify this. Recovered does not mean cured. Okay? I promise you, if I have not been through the big book and worked the 12 steps with a sponsor, I am recovering. Okay? These guys were recovered because they had done that. So, you know, look at it how you want to. But if you've gone through the 12 steps, you are recovered alcoholic. But recovered and cured are two different things. Okay? To show other alcoholics precisely how we have recovered is the main purpose of this book. So if this book is the basic text, we already established in the preface, right? This book is the basic text for our society. Isn't that what it said? And then it says that the main purpose of this book is to show other alcoholics how we have recovered. So would it be important to say that the main purpose of this program is this book? Would it be safe to say that, since it said what it said in the preface about that? This book is very, very important. Okay? It's the only thing that I can carry on to another alcoholic that's foolproof. It really is. It's foolproof because all the information's right here. That ain't opinion. It's all right here. And anything that I may say today that doesn't contradicts this book, you can disregard it. Okay? Because I'm sharing my experience on this. So the book is an absolute necessity to overcome alcoholism. For them, we hope these pages will prove so convincing that no further authentication will be necessary. You know, that says maybe I don't need any other books to recover from alcoholism. Now, once I've recovered, then I can get into some other literature. Okay, then I can start reading my daily reflections, and I can start becoming a guru on a daily basis. I can start praying and meditating in the morning. But first of all, I better recover first. See, what we got going on is we're reading all kinds of other literature that is real good information. Don't get me wrong. It's all AA literature. But we've already established this book is the basic text for recovery. The end, period, the end. Okay? Not living sober. This book. Okay? It says, no further authentication will be necessary. That means there's no reason. I don't have to change this. I don't have to go write my own version of it. You know, although my ego says it'd like to. I got to tell you. I was thinking about, man, I wonder if we could come up with our own version. I'm like, dude, that's absolutely insane. You know? See, my mind can still go out there. And I have to tell you guys this. I have to say it out loud so I can hear myself. But that's the kind of mind we're working with here. I'm talking about how important this book is, and then I got a mind that says maybe I could come up with my own version. You know what I mean? We think this account of our experiences will help everyone to better understand the alcoholic. Many do not comprehend that the alcoholic is a very sick person. And besides, we are sure that our way of living has its advantages for all. Guess what? They've got over, what, 212-step programs now? AA was the very first 12-step program. Now they've got, you name it, Narcotics Anonymous, Sex Addicts Anonymous, Gamblers Anonymous. It goes on and on and on. And what that says to me is anybody can benefit from this way of life. Okay? I.e., I think that's why there's been people go out and start 12-step programs that were based upon our 12 steps. Because AA was the first 12-step program. And now you've got over 200. Second paragraph, it says, it is important that we remain anonymous because we are too few at present to handle the overwhelming number of personal appeals which may result from this publication. Being mostly business or professional folk, we could not well carry on our occupation in such an event. We would like it understood that our alcoholic work is an avocation. Real important word, guys. Highlight, underline, parentheses, avocation. The definition of avocation is, I've got my little big book dictionary here. And I'm going to give you some opinions on this. You can agree with them or not. But activity which is less important than one's regular job. Okay? That's the actual definition. Activity which is less important than one's regular job. An avocation, to me, means I do this for free and for fun. Okay? Whenever I get done talking today, I'm not going to ask you guys to write me a check for my services. Okay? Because this is an avocation. If I start charging money for this, you might as well go buy me a funeral plot. Okay? Really. You might as well. And this is my opinion and my opinion only. I think that's part of the reason treatment centers don't have the success that Alcoholics Anonymous does. Okay? They're charging money for what we do for free. And I guarantee you the message that one alcoholic carries to another, one alcoholic that has recovered, is going to have a lot more power than me having to pay some guy $5,000 to go stay in his treatment center. Don't get me wrong. Treatment centers have a place. They're about discovery. They're about drying out. They're about getting the booze and the drugs out of my body. But one alcoholic helping another for free and for fun is the oldest principle known to man. You cannot charge money for this. Okay? And that's what avocation means to me. We do this for free and for fun. And thank God for that. Thank God for that. Then it says, when writing or speaking publicly about alcoholism, we urge each member of our fellowship to omit his personal name, designating himself instead as a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Okay, that's an anonymity statement. And what it means to me, in the way my sponsor described it, he says you can give your full name within the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. The anonymity statement is more to protect your fellow AA member, your friends in AA, rather than yourself. Okay? It'd be like if I went outside and I said I saw Matthew and I gave his last name to somebody that's not in AA, I just shattered Matthew's anonymity. Okay? That's if I'm outside of this room and I give Matthew's full name and the person I'm talking to is not an AA member. I shattered his anonymity. And I got to tell you, I've done this stuff once or twice in my sobriety without even realizing I was doing it. Like running into somebody I know and we have a mutual friend, like, hey, did you hear so-and-so's going to AA? Whoop, I didn't realize it. I just broke that guy's anonymity. You know what I mean? So the important thing for me to understand, it says when writing or speaking publicly. This is not publicly. Publicly is at the Kiwanis Club, it's at your local high school, your local middle school, wherever. That's publicly. So if I'm out speaking in public, you know, as a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, I can only give my first name. I can't say my name is Scott Mann, I'm an alcoholic. I say my name is Scott, I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's what Bill Wilson was talking about. And you know why? Because back then they only had 100 members. Guess what? They didn't have every group in town for people like us to go speak at. They had to go to churches. They had to go to the Kiwanis Club because they didn't have anywhere to go speak. That's why Bill Wilson wrote this anonymity statement. This does not apply as greatly to us today as it did to them back then because there was only 100 of those people. You know, they were very limited on where they could go share their stories. And we're going to read about that in the foreword of the second edition, where they go and they spoke at a couple of special dinners for people that were non-AA members. So the important thing for me to know is within the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, I can give my full name. But once I leave these rooms and I go speak in public as a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, I better just give my first name only, okay, to protect AA and protect anonymity. Next paragraph says, very earnestly we ask the press also to observe this request, for otherwise we shall be greatly handicapped. We are not an organization in the traditional sense. conventional sense of the word. There are no dues or fees whatsoever. The only requirement for membership is an honest desire to stop drinking. We are not allied with any particular faith, sect, or denomination, nor do we oppose anyone. We simply wish to be helpful to those who are afflicted. Last sentence sounds kind of like that avocation again. Just, I really want to be helpful to those who are afflicted. I don't, you know, have any other don't have any other real needs that I need to have met here than help somebody that's a fellow alcoholic. Funny about this, the foreword of the first edition, Bill, our third tradition, stated the only requirement for membership was an honest desire to stop drinking. Well, if we look at it now, it doesn't say anything about honest. And now this is folklore, but I heard Bill took honest out because there ain't an alcoholic on the planet who knows how to be honest when he comes in here. And I heard that's why he took it out. But anyway, matter of fact, I don't know if I could have handled that either when I came, because honesty was definitely not my best policy, I got to tell you. So I think it's kind of ironic. He originally had honest in there, and now it's just a desire to stop drinking, which is important. We shall be interested to hear from those who are getting results from this book, particularly from those who have commenced work with other alcoholics. Okay? We should like to be helpful to such cases. It says inquiry by scientific, medical, and religious societies will be welcome. That's pretty open-minded, wouldn't you say? Pretty open-minded. He's saying we'd be glad to hear from scientists, doctors, religions. And that once again reconfirms that AA does not have all the answers to every problem known to man. Okay? Otherwise, he wouldn't be saying, you know, you're welcome to ask us any questions you might have. Okay? We don't have all the answers. I'm not a doctor. I'm not a lawyer. I'm not a romance counselor. Okay? I'm just a sober member of AA who has stayed sober. And that's what I really have to pass on fundamentally. Okay? Forward to the second edition, which is on page 15, Roman numeral 15. I want to say this real quick while we're doing it, guys. Matthew, I don't know if you mentioned that we're going to have we want to have kind of an ask it basket question and answer time. So for anybody that has any questions on what we're going over today that you want to ask, go ahead and write it down on a piece of paper, put it in the basket, and when we have a little break after the first hour, we'll come back and try to answer all those questions. And if we can't get to all of them for some reason, we'd be glad to answer any questions at the end of the deal today. So, guys, feel free to write down any questions you might have, okay? Because that's what we're here for. Forward to the second edition. So this was written in 1955. AA is 20 years old at this point, okay? So it's been 16 years since the last writing. It says, since the original foreword of this book was written in 1939, a wholesale miracle has taken place. Our earliest printing voiced the hope that every alcoholic who journeys will find the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous at his destination. Already, continues the early text, twos and threes and fives of us have sprung up in other communities. What that's saying to me is AA is continuing to grow. Okay? It's continuing to grow. And even after 16 years, it's continuing to grow. So 16 years have elapsed between our first printing of this book and the presentation in 1955 of our second edition. In that brief space, Alcoholics Anonymous has mushroomed into nearly 6,000 groups whose membership is far above 150,000 recovered alcoholics. So we've got 150,000 recovered alcoholics. In 16 years prior, we had 100. So do you think this program works? Do we have any doubt yet? We still got any doubting Thomases out there like me? We went from 100 recovered alcoholics, 16 years later, we got 150,000. That speaks for itself, I'd say. Groups would be found in each of the United States and all of the provinces of Canada. AA is flourishing communities in the British Isles, the Scandinavian countries, South Africa, South America, Mexico, Alaska, Australia, and Hawaii. All told, promising beginnings have been made in some 50 foreign countries and U.S. possessions. Some are just now taking shape in Asia. Many of our friends encourage us by saying that this is but a beginning, only the augury of a much larger future ahead. And let's look up augury, because I forgot what that meant. Okay. Augury. Augury is a sign, an indication, something that indicates future happenings. Okay. Hey, Bill uses a lot of language in here. I got this little big book dictionary when I was in Akron at Founders Day this year. And I tell you, this thing is a lifesaver, man. And you can buy them online, too, by the way. They've got, I don't know if you've seen them before. The spark that was to flare into the first AA group was struck at Akron, Ohio in June 1935 during a talk between a New York stockbroker, Bill Wilson, and an Akron physician, Dr. Bob Smith. 6 months earlier, the broker had been relieved of his drink obsession by a sudden spiritual experience. Following a meeting with an alcoholic friend who had been in contact with the Oxford groups of that day, he had also been greatly helped by the late Dr. William D. Silkworth, a New York specialist in alcoholism who is now accounted no less than a medical saint by AA members, in whose story of the early days of our society appears in the next pages. From this doctor, the broker had learned of the grave nature of alcoholism. Though he could not accept all the tenets of the Oxford groups, he was convinced of the need for a moral inventory, confession of personality defects, restitution of those harmed, helpfulness to others, and the necessity of belief in dependence upon God. There's a lot of information there, guys. Okay? So basically, this started June 1935. Bill Wilson and Dr. Bob got together. I like to get a little bit, let's see here. Okay, I think it goes in the next paragraph. I'll actually get further into the stories. But Bill and Dr. Bob were both members of the Oxford groups. And brief history on the Oxford group, it was a program that was very similar to Alcoholics Anonymous. They believed in one alcoholic helping another. But the Oxford groups was a religious organization. Okay, and they were very clear about that. I believe they even had membership dues. Okay? And I think that a lot of their strict doctrine of religion is what ended up being part of their downfall. Why they did not succeed as well as AA is because they had a lot of religious ideas. Okay, so Bill and Dr. Bob were both members of the Oxford group. And Bill could not accept all the tenets of the Oxford group. And the tenets of the Oxford group, as my sponsor shared with me, are what they call the four absolutes. Okay, and you don't read about this in the big book, but it's very, very, very important. Because the four absolutes is what ended up being the 12 steps that you guys know today. Okay, and that was absolute honesty, with basically is the first step, getting honest that I'm powerless over alcohol, my life's unmanageable. Absolute honesty, absolute purity, absolute unselfishness, and absolute love. Those were the tenets of the Oxford group. And Bill, I think, was more... I just don't think the guy was ready yet. You know what I mean? I mean, we can say it was religion and he couldn't accept it, but really, the dude just ain't hit bottom yet, is what it gets down to. But he realized there were some tenets from the Oxford group that were absolute necessities. And he already saw, he had the awareness of that. But he just didn't know how to put it into his life yet. So, next paragraph down says, prior to his journey to Akron, the broker had worked hard with many alcoholics on the theory that only an alcoholic can help an alcoholic. Okay, but he had succeeded only in keeping sober himself. You guys probably heard about that story. He'd been helping drunks for like 6 months, and none of them had stayed sober for any amount of time whatsoever. And so he went to his wife, Lois. And he said, Lois, you know, I just don't know if I'm doing the right thing. I don't know what's going on here. And none of them are staying sober. And she looked at Bill and she said something very poignant. She said, Bill, but you are. See, that's it, baby. That's the ticket to freedom right there. You see, whether you guys accept what we're talking about up here and whether you stay sober or not, ultimately I want you to stay sober. I wouldn't rather have anything else in the world. But I guarantee I'm going to. Okay? And this is important to understand. By getting out of myself and helping others, that's how we find sobriety. You know? So Bill was staying sober. They weren't staying sober, but Bill was. So anyway, the broker went to Akron on a business venture, which had collapsed, leaving him greatly in fear that he might start drinking again. He suddenly realized that in order to save himself, he must carry his message to another alcoholic. That alcoholic turned out to be the Akron physician. Okay, I'm going to give you a little history on this because I learned about it a lot this year when I went to the Founders Day in Akron, Ohio. Which, by the way, if you guys have never been, I would highly recommend it. It was a once-in-a-lifetime AA experience for me. We went to the Mayflower Hotel. We saw where actually Bill was when he made the phone calls and saw the bar that he almost went in and drank. And we went to Henrietta Seiberling's gatehouse where Dr. Bob and Bill met that day and where they started the whole program. But basically what happened is Bill was in a real bad place. He had gone to Akron on business. Apparently the guy had lost his ASS and he really wanted to take a drink. Okay? And he already had realized that the guy, he can't stay sober on his own. And so he started pacing the lobby at the Mayflower Hotel. Okay? He heard the camaraderie. There was a bar room upstairs that literally and I've been there, so the bar room is maybe 20 feet from the lobby where Bill was. So I can see that the guy was probably pretty tempted. It's only about a 20-foot walk to order him a drink. And I think he said he thought about going in and ordering the drink right there. And so he went in instead. Or actually what happened is he had a thought cross his mind. He was going to order the drink so he could have some camaraderie, so he could make a friend for the weekend so he wouldn't be alone. There's that loneliness that we all deal with. And instead, a thought came to his mind, what about the other alcoholics? Okay? Pretty powerful right there. You know why? That guy was he was at the lowest point of his life, about to take a drink of booze, and the thought that came to that man's mind is, what about the other alcoholics? That's powerful. You know what I mean? So Bill went into the bar, story goes, and instead of ordering a drink, he got change. And so he could go out to the payphone in the lobby. Now this is the story I got this year when I went up there. Okay? Bill got on the phone. He started going down the church directory. It was Mother's Day, by the way. You know, Mother's Day, people are spending it with their families. It's a pretty busy time of year, you know? And so this guy starts calling people on this phone list. And he got to 10 phone calls. He got to his 10th phone call before anybody truly responded to what he was saying. You know, can you imagine a guy calling on Mother's Day and saying, "Hey, my name is Bill Wilson. I'm an alcoholic staying at the Mayflower Hotel. I need to find another alcoholic to talk to." You know what I mean? I mean, if I got a phone call before I came here like that, I might be like, "This dude's neurotic." You know what I mean? So, and I think some of the phone calls he made within those 10 calls, a couple of the people said, "Well, why won't you come join us in church tomorrow?" You know, so some of them were compassionate, but they still couldn't provide another alcoholic. And so I believe about the 10th phone call, he called a person named Walter Tunks, a reverend. Okay? Walter Tunks was very receptive, although he was busy too. He said, "I do think I know somebody." And he knew Henrietta Seiberling. Okay? So Walter Tunks put Bill with Henrietta Seiberling. Well, Henrietta Seiberling came from the Goodyear Tire and Rubber family in Akron, Ohio. You guys have heard of Goodyear Tires. Her husband was one of the founders of Goodyear Tire, Henrietta. And Henrietta, Walter Tunks knew Henrietta because Henrietta was a member of the Oxford Groups. See, there's the Oxford Group connection again. And so Bill called Henrietta, and Henrietta was the first person really who took the time of day to talk to Bill Wilson that day. She was the first one who stopped what she was doing. We owe a lot to that person, that girl, that woman. She stopped what she was doing to help Bill Wilson that day. And she says, "You know, Bill, I'm not an alcoholic, but I sure understand you guys. I can only imagine that you're in a tough place, and I can see why you'd want to talk to somebody else." And so she said, "I do know somebody." She said, "I have a dear friend. Her and her husband are a member of the Oxford group too. Her name is Ann Smith." And so Henrietta made a phone call to Ann. And Dr. Bob was pretty much three sheets in the wind that day. So Ann said, "Hey, Henrietta's on the phone, Bob, and there's some man from Akron staying at the Mayflower Hotel who'd like to talk to you." And Bob was wasted at this point. It's like late in the afternoon, you know, on Mother's Day. He said, "Oh, I don't want to talk to that guy. Tell him to call tomorrow." You know what I mean? And anyway, long story made short, Henrietta said, "Well, Bill, Dr. Bob, you know, he's not in a good place today, but can you make it till tomorrow?" And just by Bill being willing to make all those phone calls he made, he was able to get through the day sober that night. And so the following day is when they actually met, Bill and Dr. Bob, the day after Mother's Day. Okay, and they met at Henrietta's Gatehouse. And if you guys see this property that she owned, her and her husband, it's unbelievable. It's a mansion. And this gatehouse is the size of an average person's house. And they've got it all set up with all these historical AA stuff. I mean, it's really pretty amazing. But anyway, Bill and Dr. Bob, Henrietta and Ann, Dr. Bob's wife and Henrietta, put those two guys together. Okay? And Dr. Bob said, "I'm only going to give the guy 15 minutes. Okay? Well, 6 hours later, they left there. And Bill Wilson obviously didn't take a drink. Dr. Bob didn't end up getting drunk after Bill went back to New York. He had to go back out for one more experiment. He wasn't quite convinced, you know? But shortly thereafter, and Matthew's going to touch on this the next part of our session, he's going to touch on what Bill finally said to Dr. Bob to sway his opinion, to change his mind. But that's basically what happened is as a result of a series of phone calls, like four or five people, Bill Wilson and Dr. Bob finally got together. Now, I got to tell you, that is willing to go to any length to stay sober. Would you agree? Okay. This guy made 10 phone calls, had to go through 5 more phone calls after that, and we're all standing here now. And I want to think about myself today. Poor me. Poor pitiful me. You see what I'm saying? We are selfish and self-centered, man. And we don't even see the light of what our forefathers in AA did for us, man. I mean, that guy was willing to go to any length. That's the best description I think I've ever heard. Being left all alone in a strange town and making 10, 15 phone calls before you find another alcoholic to talk to. That's what it takes, man. Anyway, that's enough on that. But that's a little bit of what happened for Bill and Dr. Bob to get together. It says, the physician had repeatedly tried spiritual means to resolve his alcoholic dilemma, but had failed. But when the broker gave him Dr. Silkworth's description of alcoholism and its hopelessness, the physician began to pursue the spiritual remedy for his malady, with a willingness he had never been able to muster before. And Matthew's going to touch on that one after the break. He's going to go a little deeper into the language of the heart. He sobered never to drink again up until the moment of his death in 1950. This seemed to prove, once again, that one alcoholic can affect This seemed to prove that one alcoholic could affect another as no non-alcoholic could. Okay, and I would absolutely agree with that. It also indicated that strenuous work, one alcoholic with another, was vital to permanent recovery. I think everything we've read about so far goes back one alcoholic helping another, doesn't it? You know what I mean? I hadn't seen strenuous work with other alcoholics in a long time, guys. Have you guys ever seen strenuous work with other alcoholics? No, you have?
Okay. Yes, I have.
Okay.
In Dallas.
It's few and far between now, though, isn't it?
Not in Dallas.
Not in Dallas? Good. Well, we just need to bring that over here to Fort Worth, don't we? So let's go on. Top of page, we're on Roman numeral 17. Hence, the two men set to work almost frantically. I mean, he uses some pretty big words to describe this. Upon alcoholics arriving in the ward of the Akron City Hospital, their very first case, a desperate one. Man, and that's what it takes. He's got to be desperate to get this. Recovered immediately. Now, I hear that he really didn't recover immediately. I hear that it took a while for Bill Dotson to recover, but and became AA number 3. He never had another drink. And by the way, AA number 3 was a man by the name of Bill Dotson. Okay? He never had another drink. This work at Akron continued through the summer of 1935. There were many failures, but there was an occasional heartening success. When the broker returned to New York in the fall of 1935, the first AA group had actually been formed, though no one realized it at the time. Okay, so the first official AA group was in Akron. Okay, that's where the first official group was. A second small group promptly took shape at New York, to be followed in 1937 with the start of a third group at Cleveland, which was, I believe, started by the man by the name of Clarence Snyder. Okay, a lot of people say that Clarence Snyder is the guy who invented sponsorship. A lot of people say he's the one who is responsible for sponsorship. He wrote the Home Brewmeister, and I believe it was the first or second edition of the Big Book. Very, very spiritual man. I was reading some information on Clarence Snyder. And Clarence, when he got a newcomer, he took that newcomer through the steps in about 72 hours. All 12 steps in 72 hours. Again, I hadn't seen that around here in a long time. Okay, and I don't do it myself. I don't do it myself. But can you imagine? That's serious business. And another thing about Clarence, though, he was a very religious man. And so part of him sponsoring somebody is they had to accept Jesus Christ as their Lord and Savior. And I'm not going to go into that deeply, but of course we can talk about that too, because it all goes back to the big book anyway. But Clarence was the guy who, I believe, started AA in Cleveland. That's been my understanding. And he did a lot of miracles. He performed a lot of work in Alcoholics Anonymous. Incredible man. Besides these, there were scattered alcoholics who had picked up the basic ideas in Akron or New York, who were trying to form groups in other cities. By late 1937, the number of members having substantial sobriety time behind them was sufficient to convince the membership that a new light had entered the dark world of the alcoholic. And what that meant to me is the miracle of God was finally working in their life. It was now time, the struggling groups thought, to place their message in a unique experience before the world. And once again, that's when they realized, we got to put all this down on paper. We got to be able to pass this on and be able to show people what we're talking about. You know what I mean? And that's when Bill Wilson started writing this book. The determination bore fruit in the spring of 1939 by the publication of this volume. The membership had then reached about 100 men and women. The fledgling society, which had been nameless, now began to be called Alcoholics Anonymous, from the title of its own book. Okay, so once again, it all goes back to this program, the meeting we're in today, all goes back to this book. Okay, without this book, there would be no AA meeting. And see, we got the cart before the horse. We're doing it backwards. We're coming to AA, and we're just going to meetings, and we're not studying this book. But the book is what should come first, then the meetings. You see what I'm saying? So once again, the book is how the whole fellowship really began. The flying blind period ended, and AA entered a new phase of its pioneering time. It's because they finally had something they could read and study. It wasn't opinion anymore, you know. Those first 4 years, there's a lot of opinion because they didn't have anything really set in stone yet. With the appearance of the new book, a great deal began to happen. Dr. Harry Emerson Fosdick, the noted clergyman, reviewed it with approval. In the fall of 1939, Fulton Owsler, the editor of Liberty Magazine, printed a piece in his magazine called Alcoholics and God. And I actually printed that off the internet yesterday. I was doing some research on what we're doing. And it's a very cool story, if you guys haven't read it, this Alcoholics and God. This brought a rush of 800 frantic inquiries into the little New York office, which meanwhile had been established. Each inquiry was painstakingly answered. Pamphlets and books were sent out. Businessmen traveling out of existing groups were referred to these prospective newcomers. New groups started up, and it was found, to the astonishment of everyone, that AA's message could be transmitted in the mail as well as by word of mouth. By the end of 1939, it was estimated that 800 alcoholics were on their way to recovery. Okay. I'm big on statistics and numbers. So, in the spring of 1939, when Bill wrote this book, there were 100 members, right? 100 recovered alcoholics. And by the end of 1939, after this book was put out in the world, there were 800. Okay, so we're talking about a six-month period. We went from 100 members to 800. In the 4 years prior, without this book, we only got 100 members. Okay? So you can again see the importance of this book, that this was truly the way they carried the message to one another. In the spring of 1940, John D. Rockefeller Jr. gave a dinner for many of his friends to which he invited AA members to tell their stories. News of this got on the world wires, inquiries poured in again, and many people went to the bookstores to get the book Alcoholics Anonymous. By March 1941, the membership had shot up to 2,000. Then Jack Alexander wrote a feature article in the Saturday Evening Post and placed such a compelling picture of AA before the general public that alcoholics in need of help really deluged us, which means overwhelmed. By the close of 1941, AA numbered 8,000 members. The mushrooming process was in full swing. AA had become a national institution. Okay, so spring of 1939, we got 100 members. By the end of 1941, we got 8,000. And in the first 4 years without this book, we only got 100, period. So we went from 100 members to 8,000 in 2.5 years after this book came out. Okay? Again, it's one thing to have experience and share your opinion with an alcoholic, but it's another thing to have it in writing. Okay? So this is the message, this book. Our society then entered a fearsome and exciting adolescent period. The test that it faced was this. Could these large numbers of erstwhile erratic alcoholics successfully meet and work together? Probably not. Would there be quarrels over membership, leadership, and money? Would there be strivings for power and prestige? Yes, yes, yes. Still have it today. Would there be schisms which would split AA apart? Soon AA was beset by these very problems on every side and in every group. But out of this frightening and at first disrupting experience, the conviction grew that AAs had to hang together or die separately. We had to unify our fellowship or pass off the scene. Okay, so now that we got, there was 8,000 of us, and we're growing by the day, you get a lot of egotists, you get a lot of alcoholics together in one place, what happens? You get a lot of egos too, right? You get a lot of egos. And so these guys started getting together, and there were so many of them that they started having some group problems. They started having a lot of opinions, a lot of fights, a lot of arguments. And Bill Wilson realized that something has to happen here. And that's when he started writing the 12 traditions. He realized that's the only way that we were going to stay together. Otherwise, we were literally going to kill one another. And that's the whole purpose of the 12 traditions. I promise you, if Bill wouldn't have written them, we wouldn't be having this meeting today. Okay, we would have absolutely killed one another with our egos and our opinions by now. I mean, you get alcoholics. I'm speaking from my own experience, one of the most egotistical people in the world. We are the most arrogant people known to man, and you get all of us together. Katie, bar the door, man. Because you're going to have some egos. And so Bill realized that. And that's why he wrote the 12 traditions. Another thing I want to say about this, guys, and everything I share is my experience. There's a reason groups are ununified. Okay? There's a reason. It's because there's no personal recovery first. There's no personal recovery first. I have to recover through this book, through the 12 steps, before I can ever become unified. Matter of fact, before I work the steps, guys, I got to tell you, none of this mattered to me whatsoever. I talk about drug addiction, sex addiction, you name it, in AA meetings. Because I hadn't recovered. My ego was still running the show. My mind had not changed yet. I had not had a psychic change. So before the traditions can truly be practiced by an individual member of AA, he has to have recovered through the 12 steps. That's how it's always been for me. The person that I was before I recovered is not a unified person. Got to tell you, I am not a unified individual by myself alone. And that's why we don't have unity in our groups, guys. It's because we got a lot of members that have not recovered through the 12 steps. I hate to tell you, that's it. Okay? Don't want to sound like a bleeding deacon, so I'm going to leave it at that. But this is my experience. Second paragraph down on Roman numeral 19, as we discovered the principles by which the individual alcoholic could live, which is the 12 steps, right? The principles by the individual alcoholic. So we had to evolve principles by which the AA groups and AA as a whole could survive and function. But again, the principles came first, didn't it? The steps come first. Then come the traditions. Okay? It was thought that no alcoholic man or woman could be excluded from our society, that our leaders might serve but never govern, that each group was to be autonomous and there was to be no professional class of therapy. There would be no fees or dues. Our expenses were to be met by voluntary contributions. There was to be the least possible organization even in our service centers. Our public relations were to be based on attraction rather than promotion. It was decided that all members ought to be anonymous at the level of press, radio, TV, and films. And in no circumstances should we give endorsements, make alliances, or enter public controversies. I'm just thinking about endorsements. You know, I'm thinking about basketball players, they get an endorsement from Nike or Reebok. You know, it'd be like me going out and endorsing Budweiser beer. You know what I mean? We can't get involved in those outside issues. Okay? They will destroy us. They will destroy us. And so that's the 12 traditions right there. That's when Bill wrote them. It says, this was the substance of AA's 12 traditions, which are stated in full on page 561 of this book. Though none of these principles had the force of rules or laws, which that means I can't throw you in jail if you don't live by the traditions. Okay? But quite frankly, you're going to throw yourself in jail. You're going to throw yourself in jail. I'm not going to have to. You're going to be in a spiritual prison if you don't live by it. I lost my train of thought. Though none of these principles had the force of rules or laws, they had become so widely accepted by 1950 that they were confirmed by our first international conference held at Cleveland. Today, the remarkable unity of AA is one of the greatest assets that our society has. And I can't go on and on enough about it. While the internal difficulties of our adolescent period were being ironed out, public acceptance of AA grew by leaps and bounds. For this, there were two principal reasons. The large numbers of recoveries in reunited homes, these made their impressions everywhere. Of alcoholics who came to AA and really tried, 50% got sober at once and remained that way. 25% sobered up after some relapses. And among the remainder, those who stayed on with AA showed improvement. Other thousands came to a few AA meetings and at first decided they didn't want the program. But great numbers of these, about 2 out of 3, began to return as time passed. A lot of information there too, guys. It tells me right there, and this is the foreword of the second edition, was written in 1955. So this reflected our fellowship in 1955. It says, of alcoholics who came to AA and really tried, i.e. worked the 12 steps, 1 out of 2 got sober and stayed sober. Okay, what do you think our statistics are today?
A lot lower.
Okay, now I heard 1 out of 20 gets a five-year medallion, and I think I got that from a guy speaking about the Dallas Central office. they added up how many desire chips they sold in comparison to how many five-year medallions they sold. And for every 20 desire chips that the Dallas Central office sold, they only sold 1 5-year medallion. Okay? So that basically says 1 out of 20 that gets a desire chip is going to get 5 years of sobriety. Well, this just says that 1 out of 2 got sober and stayed sober in 1955. Okay, so what's the problem here, guys? We're not sharing this book anymore. That's the problem. We're sharing treatment center lingo, Narcotics Anonymous lingo. We're sharing all kinds of crap that has nothing to do with AA. That's the problem. Okay? This book, 1 out of 2 got sober, and then it says 1 out of 4 sobered up after some relapses. So, I mean, I think I remember reading that Dr. Bob's home group in Akron, they had a 93% success rate. Okay, you guys can research this. The home group, the first group of Alcoholics Anonymous that Dr. Bob was a member of, a 93% success rate. Okay? We got 5% success rate now. Okay, what's the problem? We're not sharing the message of this book. Period. The end. Okay? This book will get us back to the success rate where more alcoholics recover. Because our forefathers already promised us that through their own experience. And you cannot argue with experience. Okay? Our forefathers taught us before we ever came here. Thank God for that. Because believe me, I couldn't have done it. I needed some guidance, and I'm grateful for this. I'm going to read a little bit more, and then we're going to take a short break, guys. Let's see. Another reason for the wide acceptance of AA was the ministration of friends. Friends in medicine, religion, and the press. Together with innumerable others who became our able and persistent advocates. Without such support, AA could have made only the slowest progress. Some of the recommendations of AA's early medical and religious friends will be found further on in this book. Once again, that reiterates, I am not a doctor. Okay, I'm not a lawyer. I'm not a counselor. It's saying right there, the greatest asset of our program is our friends in medicine, religion, and the press. So that lets me know, once again, that I have to seek outside help. Okay, I don't have all the answers. And that's another thing. The book tells us that. It's very clear. We have to seek the help of people outside of this program to help us in other areas. Alcoholics Anonymous is not a religious organization. Neither does AA take any particular medical point of view, though we cooperate widely with the men of medicine as well as the men of religion. Once again, you know, I need doctors and I need preachers. I need both of them. And I use both of them. Okay, I go to church and I also go to my doctor. I think it's very important. Alcohol being no respecter of persons, we are an accurate cross-section of America. And in distant lands, the same democratic evening up process is now going on by personal religious affiliation. We include Catholics, Protestants, Jews, Hindus, and a sprinkling of Muslims and Buddhists. More than 15% of us are women. Okay. Well, the first thing that came to my mind is the Pentecostal church couldn't claim that. Okay, we couldn't claim Catholics, Protestants, Jews, Hindus, and Muslims and Buddhists all in one place. Okay, I promise you that's not the way I was brought up. I was brought up to be very prejudiced, very judgmental, very close-minded. And Alcoholics Anonymous is such a powerful program, a powerful message. It doesn't matter what religion you are. Doesn't matter what color your skin is. Doesn't matter any of that. All that matters is you, if you want to recover. Okay? That's the only thing that matters. There ain't a church known to man that can claim that. Okay? There may be a few out there now. Maybe the Unity Church might be one close. But you know, guys, a 12-step program, this is powerful stuff. Okay? At our present, our membership is pyramiding at the rate of about 20% a year. So far, upon the total problem of several million in actual and potential alcoholics in the world, we have made only a scratch. And boy, that's a fact. In all probability, we shall never be able to touch more than a fair fraction of the alcohol problem and all its ramifications. Upon therapy for the alcoholic himself, we surely have no monopoly. And my sponsor told me that that means AA is not the only way. Okay? AA is not the only way for an alcoholic to get sober. For me, it has been. Because I tried the Pentecostal church. I tried psychiatrists over and over and over again. And AA was the last choice for me. But we are not the only way. If you guys can find it in another place, another arena, and you can find what we find here, baby, go get it. Get it. But, you know, for me, this has been the only thing that's held true. So, it says, yet our great hope that all those who have yet found no answer may begin to find one in the pages of this book and will presently join us on the high road to a new freedom. Okay? And we're going to take a short break. Appreciate you guys and your attention. And Matthew's going to come back up and share a little bit after that. Thank you.